21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for award-winning 21st Century Radio with your host, Dr. Zoe Hieronymus.
Shower the people you love with love. Show them the way that you feel. Things are gonna be just fine if we only will.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. I'm Dr. Zoe Hieronymus, and our executive producer is Laura Courtner. A.Y. Warshaw is our board op, and I'm so glad you're all here this evening. Joining us this portion of the program is Dr. Paul H. Smith. Paul is author of Reading the Enemy's Mind, Inside Stargate, America's Psychic Espionage Program. Once a military remote viewer, Paul Smith has expanded on his knowledge and experience and now teaches others worldwide how to utilize this capacity of non-local consciousness, its application in various environments and situations. So we're going to do an update, as we try to do every couple of years, on these wonderful new explorations of both our consciousness and its application. Thanks, Paul, for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me on.
It's been a while.
It has, yes.
And I think
it's always too long, isn't it?
Well, it's funny. When I was sitting here waiting for our show to begin, I was thinking that I think the last time I spoke to you was before you got your doctorate, before you did your doctoral work.
It's possible. It seems to me we may have had an interview in between, but I don't remember anymore.
Let's start, because there are always new listeners or people who perhaps haven't really understood yet what remote viewing is. Let's start with the basics. What, when somebody says they do remote viewing, what does that mean?
Well, it's supposed to mean that they have learned how to access distant information, such as at a different location or locked away in a room or sealed in an envelope, that they do not have access to with their normal physical senses, but only through the power of their own minds alone. And that they have learned to access that information and report it in a form that can be useful.
Now, we've talked on numerous occasions over the last, I guess, 20-some years with a variety of the remote viewers, including Ingo Swann, who helped with the original protocol. Describe for our audience how it was used when you were in the military and what the Stargate program was focused on.
Well, we used it, of course, to promote the goals of the U.S. intelligence community to help, essentially help protect U.S. security, collect intelligence on foreign threats, and so on. We had a fair amount of success at that. I think I forgot the second half of your question.
Can you describe, before we get to the second half, I had asked how it was used. Describe for the audience an example. You can make one up. It doesn't have to be a real one, but the kind of context in which you and others would be asked to participate.
Okay, so first off, I'll tell you some of the things we actually did do, just very briefly. We were tasked to try and locate hostages in Lebanon during that period when they were capturing a lot of Hezbollah was capturing a lot of Westerners and keeping them as hostages. We were asked to locate Iranian silkworm missiles, which of course were a threat to shipping in the Gulf of Arabia. We were asked to describe new Soviet weapon systems or Soviet research and development laboratories. We at one time or another targeted Chinese nuclear tests, narco traffickers, drug runners. It's almost, you could say, just about anything the intelligence community had its fingers in during the 23 years the program was alive. Some remote viewer in the military was asked to address that.
Now, originally, remote viewers were given coordinates of locations to view, and they weren't told necessarily what they were looking for. They were just told that the target was at this site. In some of the examples you gave us of, for instance, locating trafficking of something in Chinese weaponry or a nuke test, would they give you coordinates, or would they just simply say, what do you see about such and such a topic?
Well, originally they would give us latitude and longitude figures, and that worked very well, but there were a couple of problems with it. One was that the skeptics or the critics would say, well, how do we know the remote viewers just haven't memorized what's at the end of all those coordinates? Of course, given that there's a practically infinite possible combination of coordinates, that itself would be as much of a miracle as remote viewing would, it seems to me. But it turns out that there is a problem with that, with the coordinates, is the viewers do tend to get an idea of where in the world the coordinate points in general. So, for example, we did a lot of stuff against the Soviet Union. Well, after a while, you realize, oh, this coordinate's in the Soviet Union somewhere. Mm-hmm. The problem with that is not that it makes remote viewing easier, it's that it makes it harder. Because at that point, you don't know exactly where the coordinate is, but you can start getting all this stuff coming in your mind that you're kind of guessing, like, oh, Soviet Union is February, gee, it must be Siberia, blowing wind, howling wolves,
mm-hmm.
that kind of stuff.
That's a really important point, because people always ask, well, how do you keep your own mind's database from downloading when you're trying to view something with almost an empty mind state?
And the way to do that is to keep the viewer blind to the target. People have a hard time wrapping their heads around that, so to speak. When you tell them that, oh, yeah, I remote view, but I can't know what the target is. I can't consciously be made aware of what the target is. They say, how do you do that? And I'll get into that in a second, but I have to tell you another issue with coordinates. The other issue is, what if you want to remote view something and you don't have the coordinates for it, the latitude and longitude? For example, a hostage in the Middle East. If we had the coordinates, we wouldn't need a remote viewer.
Right.
So how did you deal with that? So what we did, I don't take credit for this. I was on the receiving end of this development, but they developed what we called encrypted coordinates. What they really were just arbitrary numbers that were used to designate the mission or the assignment.
So
Cherry Waite, one of the prominent hostages, might just take an arbitrary number, 8675309 equals describe Cherry Waite's location.
Mm-hmm.
The viewer gets the number, doesn't know it's Cherry Waite that you're trying to find, and just takes that number and goes through the process and eventually describes, oftentimes with great accuracy, the location of the individual you're looking for.
So from your experience, and I mean, people are always asking, you know, well, what is the science of all of this? You know, there's great intuitives, there's wonderful psychics, there's remote viewers now who have had military training. What is actually happening, particularly in an instance like this, where the person, Terry Waite, is not named, but an arbitrary set of numbers is used to assign to that target, and the viewer is given that set of numbers, even though the meaning has been assigned to it by the sender? What is happening?
Well, the engine that drives the train with remote viewing is a human human intention. Intention is very important. The way the coordinate thing works, we think, obviously, you don't have a microscope to measure this to find out what's going on. We just have to go on how the system seems to work and how the phenomenon.
Well, and I think the anecdotal proving is the fact that there's been thousands and thousands of viewings now, and there's enough out of these 30 years or more to really 40 years of being able to say with some predictability that such and such happens. So
yeah,
I'm sorry to interrupt you on that.
You're exactly right about that.
So you were about to describe for us how intention is the driving engine here.
So what happens in remote viewing theory, there's this notion of the matrix. And I know that word has become very popular of late, but it actually started out being used in remote viewing in these kinds of, in this field overall. And the matrix is, if you will, the repository of all information in the universe, and remote viewers access that information when you ask them to describe a certain target, right? It may well be that the matrix is just the physical universe at the quantum level, but that's a whole long explanation I won't get into. The fact of the matter is, there does seem to be a way that viewers access information in the universe and everything that is associated with the target. So if the tasker says 8675309 equals describe Cherry Waite's location, then somewhere out there in the ether, if you will, there is that number, 8675309, and it is linked to describe Terry Waite's location.
Because
so
the intention
I like
of
to see a remote viewer is psychic in two different ways. The first way is, of course, needs to get the information from the target that you're looking for, right? The other way is the remote viewer has to find out what the target is in the first place. Okay? And so that may be involved. You could think simplistically of it as just being telepathy. The remote viewer reads the master's mind and learns subconsciously where he or she needs to go. Or it is that they just, the viewer's subconscious just goes down to the matrix, finds the link, and then guides the viewer's conscious awareness to describe the correct target.
So either way, what's happened, there is an interfacing of some sort between the intention of the person who gives you the target, the intention of the remote viewer to find that target, whatever it is, and then the third component is the target itself, whether it's a person or a place or a thing.
Yes, that's a good way of putting it.
So then in this trinity, I mean, because what interests me is, for instance, in missing persons, which unfortunately happens more and more children. And some of us get information and we want to pass it on, or we pass it on and it's just basically treated as worthless information. Even if, and I did this recently for a missing person, I called the police out in Kansas City, I guess it was Missouri, and shared what I saw just because I see what I say. Mm-hmm. But I know when I talked to the tip line, I mean, I had them read back what I told them and they didn't really take down everything I said. And so how does this work? I mean, because there's more and more people, I think, who are sort of opening up to their intuition. Some people call it their higher self. I mean, we're going to stay within the scientific framework of remote viewing. But how can it be used, particularly in situations like this where there's so many children and missing people now?
Well, that is a challenge. The first thing I should say, I've used a missing person example, which is what a hostage case is, right?
Right.
I've used a missing person example. But the fact of the matter is that's one of the hardest things for remote viewing or any other kind of psychic behavior to do. Particularly remote viewing, because remote viewing is a descriptive methodology. You can describe targets, but you can't give specific addresses or coordinates. You know, it doesn't work in reverse order like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I like to say, well, I hate to say it, but I do say it. Remote viewing can find things; it just can't locate them very well.
Mm-hmm.
And so it can work, and if you describe a location and you describe it such a way that someone who might recognize it, then you can actually find people under those circumstances. We actually didn't have much success with the hostage thing. For that very reason, I like to use the example with Osama bin Laden, and I don't know that I've used it on your show before. Back when Osama bin Laden was still unlocated, right? People would often say, well, why don't remote viewers locate Osama bin Laden?
Mm-hmm.
And I'll say, or find Osama bin Laden. That's what they always say. Why can't you find Osama bin Laden? And I'll say, well, remote viewers probably have found Osama bin Laden. And they'll say, well, then why isn't he captured? I say, it's because it's like this. Let's say the analyst says, okay, I want your remote viewer to find Osama bin Laden for me. So the remote viewer gets targeted with the random or the arbitrary number technique, starts describing some guy with a beard in a long, narrow room that has rocky walls, and there's carpet on the floor, and there's guys with guns. And if you go out the front entrance, you find yourself in this dry, austere mountain area. And the analyst says, oh, that's exactly right. That's exactly what I'm looking for. Now, where is he? And the remote viewer is going to say, I just told you where he is.
Right.
In this room that's long with rocky mm-hmm. walls, et cetera, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the remote viewer has found Osama bin Laden, but he's not been able to actually give a direct location because you can't give latitude and longitude figures. You can't give addresses. That's not the kind of information that's accessible to a remote viewer.
So basically, sort of like honing in on a target, you could hone as long as there's a frequency for the target. That doesn't necessarily give you a location.
Right.
It gives you a description of the form, but it doesn't necessarily name the place.
Right. So that's a complicator. And we would often integrate dowsing in our locational tasks. We would remote view the target, and then we would employ dowsing to try and, you know, we find the target with remote viewing and describe it so we know we're on. Then we use dowsing to try and actually come up with a location. And
using a map or something? You mean using a map? You get the general description, and then intelligence says, well, that sounds like this mountain range, and then you would douse that area?
It could work that way, although sometimes they would just give us a whole map and say, this is the outer limits of where this person could be. Tell us where on this map we'll find him.
Right. Well, you know, because I've known many dowsers, and some of them douse for government, some of them for utilities, and they can take a map sitting here in their office from anywhere in the world and tell you where the natural resource is, how deep it is, how wide it is, how long it will be there. I mean, it's really quite remarkable. So before we take a break, then, when we're doing all of this stuff that engages that part of consciousness, which is non-local, and I'd also like to say can sort of be everywhere and every when, because you can go back in time and forward in time, how would you, you said it's a matrix, but you also have this new article up about that there's sort of the state of the field in the edge of science, if you will. Is this no longer really an edge? Are we sort of like beginning to see this as a mainframe subject?
No, I think it's still an edgy subject. And the fact of the matter is that any new and unaccepted discovery stays new and unaccepted for quite a while until science finally gets around to wrapping its head around it. I mean, there were people talking about the sun being the center of the solar system for centuries before it actually got accepted as belief.
Strange to me, because when you look at the native traditions worldwide, the shamanistic traditions in general, they've used this non-local consciousness for millennium. I mean, it's part of tradition and practice. Mm-hmm. So the fact that it's sort of come into this military framework and now it's looked at as something just also new, I mean, it's really quite ancient.
And of course, there are new things about it. But it partakes of the same thing that allows that other stuff to happen in the past. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, look, we'll take a little break, and when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about the state of the field of remote viewing. Our guest is Dr. Paul Smith, and you can learn more at his website, www.rviewer.com. There's also a link right on the front page at www.21stcenturyradio.com. Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. I'm Dr. Zoe Hieronymus. Our guest is Dr. Paul H. Smith. And if you have never read his book, Reading the Enemy's Mind, I really encourage you to. It's still, Paul, I think, just one of the finest books on the topic. And I really appreciate that you did it. And so now at your website, www.rviewer.com, is this new article, Remote Viewing, State of the Field and Edge Science. And while I asked you a lot of background questions, bring us up to date of where we are with remote viewing and what is being added to this field that is important in your from your point of view.
Well, the first thing to know is that, The first thing to know is that remote viewing has got a very robust introduction in the civilian world from the secret military world in which it was essentially born. And in 1995, the government canceled the remote viewing program and over the years has declassified most of the documentation that was associated with that program, thank goodness. A lot of people lament, well, why didn't the government still keep doing it? And my answer is, it's a good thing it didn't, otherwise you wouldn't know about it.
That's true.
If they, the fact of the...
And I have to say, there's no reason to assume that they aren't still doing it. But maybe it's a new program.
I think there's good reason to believe they aren't, although there's always a slim chance that maybe somebody in the government is.
No, you're probably right. There's too many Republicans. All right, never mind.
Actually, the irony is it was the Republicans that kept the program going.
And then they figured, oh, my God, this will actually empower the individual. We can't have this.
Well, no, it was actually a Democratic administration that canceled the program.
Well, there you go. How's that for a little paradox in the universe? All right, so...
Well, and there's some reason for that. I think... liberals tend to be more skeptical overall.
Really?
Yeah, you know, I for example, as
that's
far
so
as religion.
That's so interesting.
Right?
I wouldn't have thought that. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, as far as religion, I think you'll find more atheists are liberals than religious people are, right?
Okay.
Not necessarily. I mean, there's always exceptions. But if you just kind of survey the field, you'll see that most atheists and many skeptics tend towards the liberal side of the political spectrum. And there's perfectly good reason for that, is because the liberal side of things tends, and I'm not ruling, I'm not saying this is universal, but tends to look at things more critically, tends to want to examine things more carefully in terms of the science and all that behind it, you know. And so, in general, they tend to buy more into the scientific worldview, which unfortunately at this time is skeptical towards remote viewing and other ESP kinds of things. Now, again, there's plenty of people who are liberal and say, wait a minute, I believe in this stuff. And that's fine. I understand that.
It's very interesting. Well, I don't want to derail the conversation into one of political persuasion and disposition of mind, but it's an interesting thought and not one that I really would have guessed. I would have thought just the reverse. But in any event, so coming back to where remote viewing is today and how it's being used, because we're not the only people on the planet using it.
Yes, that's true. And, of course, you, as you pointed out, there's been these long cultural traditions from, you know, primitive cultures, so-called primitive cultures and such that practice it. But it's come into the civilian world, and that has brought both problems and blessings as far as remote viewing is concerned. There are a large number of people interested in remote viewing, many who've taken the varied classes and courses and things. But on the other hand, it's also engendered a great deal of sensationalism. It's been linked to UFOs, research in UFOs, which I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, except the way it has been done sometimes has been less than desirable and has tended to make remote viewing look a little silly to the people who aren't engaged in it, right? And so there, it has this kind of mixed sort of history in current culture. But one thing it has done, it's got a lot of people interested in it, and there have been some interesting moves to research it and apply it and explore how it can be used to enhance human well-being, and so on, right? So and one particular methodology, for example, associative remote viewing, is applicable to investments, to choosing whether buy or sell a stock, to sports betting, whatever have you. And it's had success in that. People have actually made money using remote viewing in that environment. Of course, this is what everyone wants to hear. You know, if you're psychic, aren't you rich, right?
Before you pass that point, I mean, from the Western mystery tradition, which I've been trained in, you're not rich because you're not allowed to use it for your own self-gain. I mean, that's the truth about the true esoteric arts and those who are trained within the tradition, is you're not allowed to make money on it.
Well, apparently remote viewing sidesteps that because...
Because, hey, they're Americans.
One of my students won the Texas Pick 3 lottery 2 weeks in a row using associative remote viewing.
That's interesting. Well, you know, my husband, Dr. Bob Hieronymus, after years of watching lottery system, was really trying out Jung's theory of synchronicity and discovered that the lottery numbers are related to the coordinates, the longitude and latitude of the location in which major media events occur. We also discovered, it's really quite remarkable relative to remote viewing as well, this notion of coordinates, and as Pythagoras said, all is number, that these number locations are actually frequencies of meaning. And they also found, like with the pair research with the random number generator, the same kind of thing, that groups of people's consciousness applied to a single event created something that became coherent. So he also discovered, and we found by watching the news, that we could also tell you sometimes based on the lottery number, this is a little reverse engineering, where a major event had occurred that didn't get reported.
Oh, that's kind of cool.
Yeah, so I just thought I'd pass that on because it's kind of when you mentioned that remote viewers don't do the reverse of the coordinate, we found that the lottery actually gave us that information. Anyway, it was a very interesting study. All right, so back to remote viewing and where we are today. Is there an area, you posted an article about the use of remote viewing and death. Share that, a little bit about that with us.
You're talking about my life death, life after death, and non-local mind, I think.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. I was motivated to do that. I had a whole spate of people close to me pass away in the last within the last 12 months, essentially. And in the process, I also came across an article by Stephen Hawking in which he said that people who believe in life after death are just afraid of the dark. Well, the irony of that is most of the people I know who believe in life after death aren't afraid of death.
That's exactly true.
And so, and I realized that Hawking didn't know what he was talking about here because, in fact,
it's always amazing to me how some people, because they have prominent standing and lots of funding, are asked to pronounce on all kinds of things they have absolutely no knowledge of whatsoever.
That's right.
It's fascinating.
That's the thing to keep in mind.
Yeah.
So basically my argument was, after I talked about some of these folks, I used it as a way to kind of memorialize them as well. The most recent one at that time was my mom. Passed away in April, and that's what really got me motivated here, and has the synchronicity tie-in, which we may get to here shortly. But I started thinking about that, and I already realized this because it kind of was an element in my dissertation. The fact of the matter is that all of the evidence from remote viewing and a number of the other very well-researched parapsychology phenomena point to the fact that it can only be explained that our consciousness, each human consciousness, has got to be more than just the physical structure of the brain, and in fact can extend beyond the physical limits of our bodies. Remote viewing demonstrates that. If you can acquire information from a target on the other side of the planet without leaving your living room, that's evidence your mind can extend beyond the boundaries of your body, however that happens, right? And if that is the case, and I'm cutting this argument putting it in a nutshell, if it is the case that our minds can extend beyond our bodies, then that is at least, it demonstrates the possibility that our minds or consciousness or some aspect of us may survive without, be survivable without our bodies. So, this is not proof, but it's evidence. And the fact of the matter is that modern physicalistic reductive science claims that everything's been answered. They've demonstrated that the mind just is the brain and nothing exists after this life. And this is the argument Hawking is making, right? And yet, here is this evidence that they have not explained that seems to contradict what they're saying. And so my final argument was, right, I can't prove that you live after you're dead, but I can certainly show you very powerful evidence that we may be able to be alive after death. And it keeps the door open that science has been trying to close on this whole matter. The fact of the matter is they have not proved that mind is just the brain and that life is only physically sustained. They have not proved that, even though they will continue to tell you they have. So anyway, that was my argument.
Well,
I get a little passionate
about it. But it's important because here we have sort of this mainframe science that is materialistic and atomistic. And then we have another science that some people might call fringe, but which to me is extremely scientific and holds up to the rigor of science, meaning things are repeatable, outcomes are predictable. We can tell you how to do it, maybe not explain how it works, but that can be said for almost everything in science. I mean, so it's interesting to me, this cultural lag, both in terms of a desire to use consciousness for all that it's capable of, and at the same time, a diminishment of the individual power, which is what, to me, is the bad part about the naysayers or those that are skeptics, because what they're doing is denying humanity the obvious development that is taking place.
Yeah, they're putting human nature into a box that seems to be much smaller than it really is.
Exactly. That's exactly
right. But I don't
understand
why they find that compelling. And
well,
yet
you
some
know,
of them
it,
do. Some
I don't
of them
know.
Are very
you know, you sometimes
passionate about disproving that, proving that there is no such thing as life after death, or that there is
right
no such thing as these exceptional human powers, if you will. You know?
And I think there's so much to be said for individual experience. I think everybody in our listening audience has had moments in their life where they knew something that they had no rational way of having gotten that information. But all of a sudden they know it. They have a hunch. They have a feeling. They had a dream. They have a vision. They see it in their mind's eye. What is that? So I think that every human living has experienced some of this. It's just some of us make a practice of using it. And so for yourself, how has your involvement, I mean, what were you like before you did remote viewing, and how has remote viewing changed you or broadened you or deepened you?
Well, a couple of things to answer that. First of all, in some respects, it hasn't changed me at all. I think I probably mentioned before, I'm a Mormon, a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, right?
Mm-hmm.
And our doctrine is very much involved in life after death and all those kinds of things. And I believe it pretty thoroughly. And so this didn't change any of that. We also have a notion about personal inspiration, personal revelation that is sort of compatible with this idea of remote viewing. From that perspective, it didn't change me any. Did broaden my understanding of it and take me even out beyond kind of the religious limits I had presumed were there. So that was helpful. But
do you feel that it explained any of how Joseph Smith actually received the teachings he received? I mean, does that come into play of somehow or other bringing something down from some other place?
Yeah, there is a connection. And interestingly, you know, there's a lot of people like the Pope fun at Joseph Smith because he used what he called a seer stone to get revelations, right?
Right.
I wrote a paper on that, showing how seer stones actually are not a ridiculous thing to believe.
I'm not really familiar with what seer stones are.
Well, seer stone is essentially a scrying instrument. If you're familiar with scrying, the classic example is the person with the crystal ball trying to, you know, get information,
okay.
Right? And he used it kind of in that way. But the fact is, we did things at Fort Meade, although we didn't use an instrument like that. We did things at Fort Meade that were very similar, or produced, I don't think very similar, but closely enough similar results to suggest that if Joseph Smith actually did have recourse to divine assistance, he could easily have done what he claimed to have done.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, but I don't want to get too much into the religious aspect here.
No, and I wasn't either. It's the phenomenology. I mean, I'm a phenomenologist, so I'm interested in the cloud of glory and the pillar of fire in the Hebrew Bible. You know, I'm interested in the Holy Spirit coming into the tent. It's all the same.
Of course, I got my PhD in philosophy at the University
mm-hmm.
of Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Very rigorous philosophy program, largely physicalistic. The folks there tend to be reductionist physicalists, right?
Mm-hmm.
They were open-minded enough to allow me to include parapsychology research in my dissertation. But the thing about it is, if I had come to philosophy just cold turkey without any of this background, I very soon probably would have become a reductionist physicalist as well. But because of my experience with remote viewing, I knew there was more to it than just that party line that was being promoted.
So how
and
did
so
you?
I was able to get a PhD in philosophy without losing my faith and without succumbing to that whole physicalist, materialist way of looking at things.
Can we go back to the remote viewing and life after death and your mother's passage?
Sure.
So how did remote viewing become something you could use? How did you use it?
In the military?
No. In terms of your own, whether it's applicable, you know, for instance, the Monroe Institute helps people use non-local consciousness for all kinds of things. And then others, for instance, Raymond Moody, who will help people through the psychomantium, sort of like the same thing, look on a reflecting surface and actually see the visage of a deceased person that they need to make contact with.
And so, that's a form of scrying.
Right, actually. That's what I was going to say. So did you actually use remote viewing in some form to make contact with your mother?
No, I haven't done that.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that it is possible sometimes to have communications from departed loved ones.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm leaving that up to her.
Okay.
If she wants to get in touch, then I'm open to that possibility. But I don't use remote viewing in that mode. I usually use it for more practical things.
Like?
Which is, of course, what it was designed for. But, you know, it has other benefits beyond just the actual application of it to describe a hidden target or whatever.
Right.
People who learn remote viewing, I really think, have enhanced their intuition.
Definitely.
And they may not even intend to do that when they start out. But once you have really mastered and become experienced in remote viewing, you find that your intuition itself, even when you're not remote viewing,
sure,
is enhanced.
And it makes sense, don't you think? Because as you practice receiving information and not judging it, that's ultimately what intuition is receiving information and not judging it. So as you practice that in remote viewing, I remember Ingo always saying that's the hard part is people get information and all of a sudden you want to classify, oh, it's round, it's a Ferris wheel, oh, no, it's an air balloon, you know, rather than just saying it's round.
Yes, and that's really an important element in remote viewing that people struggle to learn, and finally once they learn it, they discover they then can remote view well.
Mm-hmm.
They can remote view somewhat without learning it, but there's a lot of noise, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you learn that your left brain likes to add things to the puzzle that actually just confuse things, right? Your left brain analyzes and passes judgment and all of that in the process. And if you don't learn how to tell that from the actual signal, your information that you're producing gets all garbled up. The interesting thing, of course, is that extends then into regular life as well. In fact, one of the funny things about remote viewing is you find yourself using the remote viewing terminology to describe everyday life situations because the way people do things oftentimes mirrors how left brains interfere with the process of remote viewing. So it's kind of amusing to be able to do that. One particularly useful term is analytical overlay. And that is, in fact, the noise the left brain injects into the system when you're trying to remote view.
Mm-hmm. I also think that it's true in terms of just our rational conversation of daily affairs is that people interpret while other people are speaking and they don't really hear what the other person is saying because they're already busy with their own interpretation. You know what I'm saying? It's the same kind of
process. You're exactly right. And so we'll often say, oh, that's just a bunch of AOL when you're talking to somebody. And they come up with something that's completely not what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. We're going to take a little break. If you're just joining us, our guest is Dr. Paul H. Smith. Go to his website, www.rviewer.com. You can learn about the programs he offers and many of the articles that are posted will really interest you. You can also find a link on the front page at www.21st21stcenturyradio.com. Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. I'm Dr. Zoe Hieronymus, and our guest is Dr. Paul H. Smith. His book, Reading the Enemy's Mind, and you can learn more about his ongoing teaching and programs at www.rviewer.com. Paul, are there any upcoming programs you want to tell us about?
Well, let's see. I do have a remote viewing course coming up in November, if there's anyone who wants to learn that.
Wonderful. Where are you located?
I'm in Austin, Texas.
All right. If somebody wants to head south and west, in southwest, head on out to Paul's place. You can learn more at www.rviewer.com. Look, we're going to run out of time, and I want to be sure to ask you to tell us the story about Jacques Vallée. I mean, Jacques has been a guest of ours on and off over the last two decades, and so it's always wonderful when somebody writes about this most exceptional human being.
Yeah, well, we were both in Paris for a conference, which in and of itself was exceptional, but several days after, well, maybe it was a day or two after the conference.
What was the conference?
I and my family were walking through the Latin Quarter in Paris, and I had regretted that I hadn't been able to introduce them to Jacques Vallée before. And who should come walking towards us but Jacques Vallée right at that point? And if you think about it, it's a huge synchronicity. I actually used that meeting as a springboard to discuss synchronicity a little bit, the meaningful coincidences that you talked about earlier,
mm-hmm.
Carl Jung talked about. And the fact of us, even though we were both in Paris, the fact of us meeting at that point in that place was so improbable from a statistical perspective that it was almost like some kind of miracle had taken place, which is what synchronicities can often be, right? And Jacques was very good humored. He was happy to meet my family. And
Well, I think one of the things that interests me is that Jacques is one of these really unique researchers who has seen, I mean, what the way he talks about UFOs and multidimensionality and interdimensionality goes beyond where most UFO researchers are able to go, because he has both his scientific head in consciousness and his scientific head in physics. It's an extraordinary combination. Mm-hmm. What was the conference?
It was actually a remote viewing conference. It was sponsored by the International Remote Viewing Association, which I'm affiliated with here in the States.
Is there a difference?
And by Iris Consulting, which is a remote viewing organization in France. And so it's kind of a joint conference over there.
Is there a difference in the way remote viewing is looked at in other countries?
Well, in some countries it isn't looked at at all. People don't even know it exists.
Mm-hmm.
And that tends to be what's going on in France. However, once they hear about it, they get interested. And this organization, IRIS, is run by a gentleman named Alexis Champion. He's made it his mission to help essentially evangelize the French as far as remote viewing is concerned. And he's having some great success at it. I'm impressed. I think the French may be one of the more fertile grounds to develop a really robust remote viewing capability.
Why do you think that is culturally?
Well, the irony is that the French aren't perceived as being amenable to this kind of thing, and yet there's an undercurrent amongst them of interest in what we would call paranormal things.
And the radiosthetic arts.
There's an undercurrent there, and they're very receptive, but they also are very rational. And those two things together actually make for good remote viewers. One of the problems we've run into in the United States is I call them people who believe too much. Right?
Mm-hmm.
We seem to have problems with people who refuse to believe enough, and that's the skeptics. But there's a whole category of people who will accept anything. They have no critical they exercise no critical reasoning powers.
Sometimes I'd like to say something happens, well, at least to those of us who have sort of been doing this work our whole lives, is your mind can be open to almost any explanation. I mean, I'll give you an example of how my mind sometimes works, and people go, wow, and you have to live with yourself? So during all of those, you know, uprisings along the Mediterranean and all the different countries that ring the Mediterranean, the only thing that kept coming through my mind was that somebody was playing an excitatory frequency throughout the Mediterranean. You can use the water as a carrier of those kinds of frequencies, and you can use the air because of the ethers. And that was what I came to the conclusion, that the only reason they all happened simultaneously is that there was a beaming frequency of some sort. Now, you know, what do you do with information like that? Or the thought of it, even?
Well, of course, that's a theory that can't be proved but might be real.
Exactly.
But there are, and over the 30-some-odd years I've been involved in remote viewing, I do know that there are things that work better than others and some things that don't work at all. And when I say things, I mean like different belief patterns and different metaphysical theories.
Mm-hmm.
And some people who have these certain beliefs about what remote viewing is have a horrible time having any success at all, because what they're believing in apparently isn't true about remote viewing, you know. And that's where the critical reasoning comes in, is you evaluate what your beliefs are in terms of what seems to work, and you adjust accordingly. And that's one of the reasons remote viewing is successful, is it kind of just abandoned any kind of metaphysical trappings. It's very likely that there is a metaphysical explanation. What it is, we just don't know, right? But remote viewing kind of extracts away from that and just says, this is what you do, this is how you do it. And this is
and it works.
What your result should be.
Right.
And getting rid of all those preconceptions has really actually seemed to enhance the success of this methodology. So,
and when you look at all the different ways it's being used, are there anything? I mean, you mentioned, obviously, as with everything in the unusual realm, there are charlatans and there are authentic people. There are guides and there are teachers. And then there's just people that are just plain dangerous and you don't want to be around them.
Yeah.
But for those people in the audience who are going, well, yeah, I'd really like to know more about remote viewing. You had mentioned something I think that really is sort of one of the more important aspects to it, Paul, is that when you practice these things, it enhances your ability to use your intuition.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep,
and
that's true.
And from your experience, then, why is that important?
To enhance your intuition?
Mm-hmm.
Well, obviously, if we speak in terms of evolution, right, there's adaptations that help your genes survive. In the absolute sense of it, improving your intuition means that you have more success in making decisions, particularly crucial ones, so you increase your adaptability in a world that is sometimes dangerous, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm kind of exaggerating here because most of us don't live in dangerous circumstances, although a number of our military who've been in harm's way certainly could use all the intuition they could get, right?
Sure.
And this, in fact, was noticed with the military, even back in previous wars, that some military people, their intuition seemed to help them lead a charmed life. They could walk point, which is a notoriously mm-hmm. dangerous position on a patrol. In fact, everybody wanted them to walk point because they avoided ambushes that other people would walk into, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or they would discover mines and stuff that other people would have been tripped up by. But to take a much more mundane example, in this life, or in this world, in the civilian world, it may help you. Grasp of your intuition may help you make better decisions in your business or in your employment, or as far as your kids are concerned, or even driving in traffic, avoiding accidents.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's why I like to bring these discussions back to the daily life that humans live, because people can really see that they do remote view on their own without knowing the protocols,
mm-hmm.
and that once you actually learn the tricks of the trade, so to speak, it just gives you that many more choices. And that's what I like about all of these intuitive, non-local consciousness realities, is that it broadens your life, it deepens the meaning in things, and at least for me, it also means you can be of service to others.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And of course, that's a crucial thing that, in fact, I was just talking to some people today about that our society, our culture is really focused on me, right, on the individual, on enhancing the individual. But the fact of the matter is, we can't actually achieve our own potentials unless we are open to helping those around us in things they need. We get to ourselves through others, essentially, by helping others. I mean, that's the message that Christ taught in the New Testament. You know, those who seek themselves lose themselves, and those who go
serve,
to help others
yeah.
essentially lose themselves. They're the ones that find themselves.
I think that's true. And the more you give, the more you get. That's a song
yep.
we play all the time. I want to thank you for joining us. Actually, I was thinking, boy, if the Wall Street kids would just understand, they could take all of their human power hours and go do some good for others, they'd get a little different message. But anyway,
I absolutely agree.
Yeah, I just think youth is interesting, and it's interesting, you know, every youth group has to do it their own way. Thanks for being with us, Paul, and I'll be speaking to you again, and we'll be right back for more on 21st Century Radio.